Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Link. This Wednesday, the 9th of May, I'm Jane Ayeko-Kemet.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, governors around the Lake Chad Basin area end a two-day meeting to discuss strategies on how to tackle the Boko Haram crisis.
Countries in sub-Saharan Africa have large infrastructure gaps and development needs. And many countries in the region had the space, fiscal space, to borrow and build that infrastructure.
And medics fight to contain Ebola outbreak in DRC, where 17 people have died so far. We find out why it keeps on reoccurring.
Because it's transmitted from one person to another, the disease occurs in a cluster, meaning in numbers in the same household, maybe two, three people falling sick. That's when the trigger comes, when people start to think beyond malaria.
Stay tuned for those stories and a lot more coming up shortly.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday that three American detainees have been freed by North Korea and are returning to the U.S. with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Trump made his announcement on the social media site Twitter, saying that Kim Hak-song, Tony Kim, and Kim Dong-chul are in seemingly good health and that he would meet with them in Washington. In response, Seoul has also called for the release of six South Koreans held in detention by North Korea. In Iran, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has spoken out on President Trump pulling the United States from the 2015 international nuclear deal. He told a crowd of several hundred in the capital, Tehran, that Trump's exit threatens the country.
You heard last night that the president of America made some silly and superficial comments. He said maybe more than 10 lies. He spoke both on his exit on the nuclear deal and threatened the people of Iran and the regime, saying, I'll do this and I'll do that. Mr. Trump, I tell you on behalf of the Iranian people, you've made a mistake.
In the same speech, Iran's supreme leader, who has the final say in state matters, also said that he doesn't trust Britain, France, and Germany, three of the seven international co-signers, and that Iran would quit the deal unless Europe guarantees that trade relations will continue. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has stressed that Germany remains committed to the deal and hopes to find a solution.
We have noted with regret, but also concern, this withdrawal by the United States, which is of course serious for such an agreement. We will remain committed to the agreement and will do everything in our power to ensure that Iran also meets its obligations in the future.
Sanctions on Iran could further hinder its already stagnant economy. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. In Somalia, al-Shabaab insurgents have reportedly stoned a woman to death for allegedly having multiple husbands. Residents in the south of the country gathered to witness the stoning after the woman was convicted in an al-Shabaab court known for imposing a strict version of Islam in the Horn of Africa nation. Dozens of men and women have been sentenced to death in the courts, which do not allow for appeals or legal representation. A German labor court in Berlin has ruled that a Muslim teacher cannot wear her headscarf in class. The court upheld the state's neutrality law, which bans public service employees from wearing religious symbols. The teacher had claimed the law was unconstitutional. And finally, Wednesday marks the annual observance of an event which set the course for the creation of the European Union. Europe Day celebrates a declaration by French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman in 1950, which proposed united West German and French economic efforts to create the first European community. Schuman is considered one of the founding fathers of the EU. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link program. My name is Abubakar Jallo.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. We start the program with Boko Haram issues. Now, despite the gains made against Boko Haram by countries around the Lake Chad Basin region, the extremist group remains a threat, carrying out asymmetric attacks against civilians. 10 years down the road, Boko Haram atrocities have led to a worsening humanitarian crisis that has displaced over 2.4 million people and left more still trapped in hard-to-reach areas.
Now, governors representing Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad have agreed to work together and find a solution. Mohamed Alamin reports.
Humanitarian crisis across Lake Chad Basin, comprising northeastern Nigeria and parts of Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, was deepening. Boko Haram had lost much of the territory it once controlled, but raids and suicide bombings targeting civilians continue to cause widespread death and destruction, fear, psychological and physical trauma. It is to this effect that governors from Lake Chad region have formed a regular political mechanism to provide a platform for engaging with Boko Haram and seek to a lasting solution. The resolution was reached during a two-day meeting held in Nigeria to address security concerns around Lake Chad. United Nations Special Representative of the Secretary General for West Africa and Sahel, Muhammad Ibn Chambers, explained the reason for bringing the governors together.
The purpose of this governors forum is not to focus on the military aspect, it's to start seeing how the governors on the ground, in the states where Boko Haram is operating, in Nigeria, in Chad, in Cameroon, in Niger, can begin to collaborate, share information, share good practices, and generally see how they can be more effective working with their governments, of course, but also with international partners.
According to Edward Kalon, UNDP's representative in Nigeria, no unitary action can solve the crisis.
The crisis in the Lake Chad Basin cannot be solved through a unitary approach. We must pursue a multi-pronged approach, including humanitarian assistance to save lives in the short term, development to address the root cause of this crisis, peace and counter-terrorism.
Some participants bear their minds on the formation of the forum.
For me, I am a person who works closely on issues around violence. I work closely with men, women and girls who experience violence. And for me, this is an opportunity to redress the effects of the conflict. So I am very happy that we are seeing commitment from our leaders, the governors within the forum.
My name is Georg Schmidt. I'm the Africa Director from the German Foreign Ministry. I think it's important to bring the governors together. This is the first time that the governors, 11 governors from the region, coming together and talk, not just the central governments, because they're the local ones, they're the ones who have to implement the decisions. You need to deal with all the people from Boko Haram. How can you integrate them? Should you punish them? Should you forgive them? How do you give them a perspective, a better perspective in life?
And that report was compiled by Mohamed Alamin in Nigeria. Now let's move on to an international story. In spite of intense pressure from his allies, President Trump has announced on Tuesday that the U.S. will withdraw from a landmark multilateral nuclear deal with Iran. Under the agreement, which was negotiated by the Obama administration, the U.S. and five other world powers lifted economic sanctions against Tehran. Crispin Mwakideo reports.
If German Chancellor Angela Merkel was upset about the US withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, she didn't show it at the government's Wednesday cabinet meeting. The Chancellor offered no immediate official reaction to the announcement by US President Donald Trump on Tuesday evening. But her Foreign Minister Heiko Maas did make the German position clear.
We want to stay in the agreement. The first word from Iran is that the country will continue to fulfill its obligations under the deal. So we are going to stay calm and discuss the situation rationally in coming days.
There was outrage in Iran's parliament. Politicians wasted no time in condemning the U.S. for violating a deal signed only 3 years ago. On the streets of Tehran, Iranians were angry at the news that their economy is once again in the grip of U.S. sanctions.
This means more pressure will be exerted on the people of Iran, and the country will go back to the days of resorting to smuggling goods and bypassing sanctions.
On Tuesday, U.S. President Donald Trump signed a memorandum to reinstate harsh economic sanctions on Iran, most notably in the oil and energy sectors. All efforts by European allies to dissuade him had been in vain. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, couldn't hide her regret as she urged unity.
The European Union will remain committed to the continued, full and effective implementation of the nuclear deal. We fully trust the work, the competence and the autonomy of the International Atomic Energy Agency that has published 10 reports certifying that Iran has fully complied with its commitments.
Even if Europe remains firm, many fear that Trump's move will prompt a backlash by Iran. President Hassan Rouhani said his country might resume nuclear activities if a deal without the U.S. will not guarantee its interests.
Tonight, we witnessed an important historic experience. The same thing that we have said and repeated for 40 years has now happened. Iran is a country that is loyal to its commitments, and the U.S. is a country that never sticks to its commitments.
Without U.S. backing, the EU, Russia and China must prove that the deal is still worthwhile for Iran. Much will depend on the next few weeks as European leaders urge Iran to remain optimistic.
That was Crispin Mwakideu. Now to the DRC Congo, where 17 people have so far died from a new Ebola outbreak. The DRC's health ministry has confirmed the death, describing it as a public health emergency with international impact. Dr. Zablon Yoti is World Health Organization's technical coordinator for emergency program in Africa. He's been telling me why this keeps reoccurring.
The Ebola outbreak reoccurs in some specific areas because the virus is there in the environment, so it will reoccur in such places. In addition to that, one of the febrile illnesses which present with a fever, and there are several diseases like that, malaria, typhoid, brucella, and so on, which are very prevalent in that area. So to pick these first cases can be usually a challenge because of these other diseases which really present like the early stage of Ebola. Because it's transmitted from one person to another, and the disease occurs in clusters, meaning in numbers in the same household, maybe two, three people falling sick. That's when the trigger comes, when people start to think beyond malaria.
Now, the first notification came out on May 3rd, and since then no deaths have been reported. Is this to suggest that the outbreak is being contained?
No, the outbreak has not been contained. It's just that we need to do more investigation.
So how is the outbreak affecting people's daily lives?
It is like Ebola, even if it is occurring in a place for the second, third time. It's quite dramatic and it terrifies the community. People really fear it. If the right measures are not put in place quickly, it can spread rapidly, and it can also kill a big number of people if the medical support is not timely or if it's not adequate, and it causes panic in the community.
Now, Doctor, you are certainly immersed in the whole Ebola research and you're updated with whatever is being developed in that area. My question is there any progress in developing medication for treatment of this epidemic at all?
We've learned a lot now and we continue, of course, to improve on that knowledge. We experimented on some treatments and also with a lot of success, we use the vaccines. So one of the strong tools which we are deploying in this response is the vaccines and also experimental medicines, which have shown some positive outcomes.
Dr. Zablon Yoti, World Health Organization's Technical Coordinator for Emergency Program in Africa.
And we have some responses here. We have this one from Albert Fwamba, who says, another reason for Kabila to call for cancel of the elections and extend his stay in office. He will use the Ebola outbreak as the reason not to have elections this year.
An opinion from Albert there. Mary Catherine Palmer says, but why are they not taking the right precautions? We don't want to hear anything about this killer. Let the people of Congo practice proper health practices.
And Romeo Ajay says, their president Kabila is the most wicked man on earth now. He has hijacked everything to himself. Interesting comment.
Yeah, and Amara Bongai says he confirms what the doctor over there was saying by saying Ebola is not good in any country. Ebola kills. That's all we have for the time. We have time for. Keep those comments coming and we shall present them as and when we can. You're listening to DW's Africa Link program with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. Remember, we are also broadcasting this program live on our DW Africa page. Still to come, the growth of gambling in Nigeria.
I normally lose more than what I got from that man. But I know one day, I will achieve what I want.
But before that, let's go to this story now. Anger is building in Namibia over inaction by colonial-era Germany. More than 2 years of talks on an apology and reparations for the genocide of its Herero and Nama people, which began, yeah. German lawmakers have said the parliament doesn't even know exactly where the talks between Germany and Namibia now stands. This discussion was once regarded as a prestige project from Germany. DW's Daniel Pears, who is based in our Berlin Bureau, has been closely monitoring the case and described to me the current situation.
Well, the problem is that Germany has so far never officially apologized for the genocide. And when the negotiations between the two governments began, many people in Namibia hoped that this apology would come rather soon. And now, some years down the line, there is no apology. There is no agreement in place. And that seems to make people very bitter.
People who are negotiating on behalf of the Herero and Nama people are also blaming the Namibian government. They're putting them under pressure. Why is that?
Well, when the talks began, the Namibian government said pretty clear-cut, we are going to negotiate with the Germans on behalf of all Namibians. But some traditional leaders of the Herero and Nama, not all of them, but some, said, no, we want to be part of the negotiations. We want to talk to the German government. And started a very, very vocal campaign and criticizing the government, saying it was too soft. And then also went to a court in New York in the US to file a lawsuit against Germany. And that seems to have had an impact. These traditional leaders are very often in the media with their very, very strong statements, and that seems to have influenced public opinion, at least to a certain degree.
There is also this accusation that the government of Namibia has a secret agreement with Germany. Is that true?
Well, both the German embassy in Windhoek and the Namibian president have said that there is no such agreement in place. It has been a rumor that has been going around also through the Namibian media that this agreement was made after independence and that the Germans pledged huge amounts of development aid, and in turn the Namibians would not ask for particular compensation for the genocide.
The Namibians are really beating and dancing about this issue, talking about it, whereas in Germany it's really not much of an issue. It wasn't even mentioned in the coalition agreement between Chancellor Angela Merkel, CDU party, and the Social Democrats, the SPD. Why do you think things like this is happening? Why are German politicians not really putting much focus on this, but they rather comment on other issues, example the genocide in Armenia?
I was also surprised when I saw that it wasn't mentioned in the coalition agreement, and I think there are two reasons for this. One is that the German government, at least it appears that the German government is trying to keep these negotiations out of the public limelight. It's very hard to get information also from the Foreign Office about where the negotiations are at the moment. The only person that is talking to the media is the chief negotiator from the German side, Ruprecht Polenz. But it's very hard to get information from the Foreign Office. For example, we tried to find out when exactly negotiations would take place in Germany, and we were just given very, very vague replies. And the second thing is, I think the German government has become very cautious. In the beginning, the German government wanted a very speedy conclusion of the talk. So they came and publicly said, okay, this is what we can offer and this is what we cannot offer. But in Namibia, many people felt that this was a very arrogant stance of the German government. They said they cannot come here, ask for an apology, but then say, okay, these are the conditions that we're actually laying out for an apology. You have to ask for forgiveness, and then we are going to negotiate about what conditions are there for an apology. I think the German government is aware that these negotiations are very complicated, that they might take a lot of time, and therefore they did not put it in the coalition agreement because they didn't want to raise any wrong expectations.
I was speaking to DW's Daniel Pels.
And some quick comments coming in from our followers here. Sam Sams, that's his name, actually asks a question. Do they really want an apology or compensation from Germany? And that's not all. Some anonymous person also from Kenya is saying Germany must pay for what they did. They took our economy and that's why our countries are bankrupt. And Dicky from Brussels says Namibian government has to act very fast and demand the most needed apology. They must also seek reparation as well. And another one from Isaiah. We are being robbed culturally and mentally. Keep those are comments from our people there. You can also join the conversation by checking out our Facebook page, DW Africa.
On the spot.
Now, back in the day, the popular belief in Nigeria was that who gambled was a lazy person. But today, that image is changing. Whether you're rich or poor, educated or uneducated, more and more people are playing different games of luck, from lotteries to casinos to online sports betting. The gambling industry is booming and so is gambling addiction.
Now, Lotto is one of such games. It's especially popular among low-income earners. Small Lotto kiosk dot almost every street in Lagos. While there are always talks of people who have won huge sums of money, most of the players lose more money than they take. Floris Chukora brings us that story from Lagos.
Chukwusa Austin is a commercial motorbike rider in Lagos. He has stopped by at one of the busiest Lotto shops in the area to try his luck before carrying on with the day's work.
I've taken a break, so I'm here to play Lotto.
He plays this game at least twice every day. In fact, more than half of what he earns from his motorcycling business goes into it.
I normally lose more than what I got from that man. What I drop in a month, I can't achieve it. A day from that man, but I'm still thank God that he normally give me small as I want. But I know one day, I will achieve what I want.
Austin says a friend introduced him to the game 5 years ago, and he has played consistently ever since. So far, the highest money he has won is 48,000 naira, about $120. Ode Kingsley is the owner of this Lotto shop in Dokwemu. He says most of his customers are like Austin. After their first win, they never stop playing.
They are addicted gamblers. They play every day. Either they win or they lose, they must come to play.
Kingsley says that when he first started in 2012, he would have just 3 customers a day. But now he has at least 100 regular customers. He has 2 people working for him now, and he has even opened a second shop just across the street. The Lotto business in Lagos is booming. The more people play, the more money the agents like Kingsley make. This growth also means more tax money for the state government. The Lagos State Lotteries Board is the government agency that regulates all forms of gambling in the state. Sheun Anibaba is the head of the board. He says they are yet to find a solution to the growing addiction problem.
We have policies that cover responsible gaming, but we are aggressively working to push some of those initiatives out. So very soon we'll roll out a responsible gaming unit that will be solely tasked with addressing this concern you've raised. But like I said, you know, the operators are at the forefront because they're dealing directly with the stakers.
In the evening, Austin is back from work, but before heading home, he stops at Kingsley's shop to play Lotto. Kingsley and the government are profiting from this kind of addiction, but the problem gamblers are basically on their own.
It will be very difficult for me to stop it. Impossible. I cannot stop it. Nobody told me to go into it. I come into it by myself, So I will decide by myself to leave it.
There are no therapy centers or real policies in place to help them manage their gambling addiction. They spend all they work so hard to earn on a game that they can only win by luck.
Flores Chokora in Lagos.
Living Planet Africa.
Now, most people in rural Cameroon have just one option for cooking, firewood. But recently, a group started installing biogas cookers in rural communities. The organization now has 10 employees and its own workshop. This report by Eyong Blaise and Ute Valter is now presented by Eddie Micah Jr.
Bouma Mohammed is modifying every item by hand. It's a lot of work. He established a non-profit enterprise, Royal Renewable Energy Cameroon, or PRECAM, 3 years ago. At its workshop in the capital, Yaoundé, Mohammed and his teammate, Divide Vitinja, are building a portable gas stove. Instead of a gas bottle, the stove runs on biogas. Vitinja says some families in the countryside are already using their system.
If you are doing it, you see most families, they don't use firewood again in their houses. They go by the biogas system. All the rubbish in their house, anything that can get rotten, if they put inside the digester, and come out with a good result. You have the cooking gas, you have the insecticide that will come out from it, and then you are organic manure.
Bouma Mohammed and his team are today visiting villages north of Yaoundé to show farmers how to build and operate a biogas system.
So when the production, the decomposition take place, the gas now will rise and be at the top.
The team has taught about 300 people over the past few months. Demand for the devices and training is rising, but Mohammed says it's still sometimes hard to convince people of the advantages of this new technology.
We need that space where it can be practiced and shown to the people, because people want to see. People don't want to listen. They've listened a lot and nothing has been happening. So they want to see. So our main aim as practitioners is to carry out lots of experiments and then to show to the people that this thing works.
Royal Renewable Energy Cameroon, or PRECAM, is installing its biggest facility to date in Akono, a small town outside Yaoundé, with a large septic tank for the recycling of organic waste. It was commissioned by a Catholic seminary there at a cost of about 2,500 euros. Human, kitchen, and garden waste will all be fed into the tank. The resulting biogas will be used in the seminary kitchen, which feeds the 200 students. But not many people or institutions in Cameroon are aware of biogas as an eco-friendly energy source.
We intend to promote this technology, but you know, with no finance, no materials, no technical or support, it's very, very difficult to create awareness.
The government's development plan, Cameroon Vision 2035, aims to promote alternative energies. But so far, the biogas plays a tiny role in the energy mix.
That report was compiled by Eyong Blaise and Ute Valter, and it was presented by Eddie Micah Jr. Now, Ayoko, we did a story recently that is also similar. That is the growing gambling industry in Ghana. So you see that this is a trend that is going across West Africa.
But have you ever gambled yourself?
Never, ever. It's something I refuse to do. I don't want to do it because of some personal reasons.
Ah, yeah, that's an interesting one. Well, I personally don't believe in luck.
Have you gambled?
No, I don't gamble because I don't believe in luck. I would rather work and earn my money than believing in some luck. Anyhow, to that effect, people have been responding, I think, because it really shows how much people out there believe in gambling and they do engage. And that's also reflected on the number of people who have been commenting. Chinyeri Ezefi says, the Nigerian situation is alarming. It's like a failed state. People are being pushed to the wall to earn a living.
That's in response to a question we asked on Facebook. Will you use your remaining Naira, that's the Nigerian currency, in your pocket to gamble? Another response here from Sirajo Sanusi Gidadawa says, gambling is the only solution. I guess this person favors that.
Well, and Nyamba says, why is that we easily learn bad habits in this continent? After doing this, we blame the white man for all our problems. That's an interesting one.
Felix Udo says, when democracy is turned to a democratic system, the results are always negative. What do you think the youth will become? Betting is the source many people, including the police officer, engages in.
And Actor 2 says, you will if you are addicted and hopeless.
Let's say
That's all the responses we have for today.
Well, we have more responses, but as usual, time has never been a friend to all of us, so we'd like to leave it at that, but continue the conversation on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
It's been a pleasure, and my name is Abubakar Jallo.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
Bye now.